Well, greetings to all those on the webcast, specifically our congregation in St. John's, Newfoundland. Welcome to all of you and to others who may be listening in as well. Let's start with something Alex Trebek might say, another Canadian from Winnipeg, Manitoba. If you were on the Jeopardy game show, as many of you probably know, most of you I'm sure know, the format of the show is that you are given the answer and you have to come up with the question. That's the way it works. So here's your answer. This New Testament chapter is often called the faith chapter of the Bible. Now you have to come up with the question. So of course the correct question would be, what is Hebrews 11? If you've ever watched the show, you know that frequently, if there's a category with biblical information and knowledge, it's often the last one selected by the contestants. And sometimes, as they give their attempted correct questions, they are not so correct, and you realize why they waited until the last moment to choose that category. But now let's shift back to traditional format for messages like this, where I get to ask the questions, and you have to come up with the answers, hopefully. And I know you're thinking, no, that's not how it works. You have to ask the questions and answer them. But you know that's not how I give sermons. Frequently I suggest that you need to check out the answers. When is the last time that you did a really in-depth study of Hebrews 11, the faith chapter? Please don't be worried that we're going to do an hour exposition of every example in the faith chapter today, because then we would be very late for the afternoon service in Meadville, Pennsylvania today. Let me throw some more questions at you and see how well you might guess some of the answers. How many specific individuals are mentioned by name in Hebrews 11 as examples of faith? No fair cheating. This is a closed Bible question. How many individuals? It's also a closed computer question. The answer is 18. You might have thought there would be many, many more in some ways, but there are only 18 specific names mentioned as examples of faith in Hebrews 11. There are three other names listed specifically. One is really a title, but it refers to a specific person, but they're not examples of faith. Those other three names are Cain, Esau, and Pharaoh. Pharaoh being a title, but we understand it to be a specific Pharaoh, the Pharaoh in the time of Moses. There are numerous references to groups of people. These phrases appear, the prophets, others, still others, they, all these. And there is one more group reference that I'll say in a moment. Now, of the 18 that I've counted, two names are not actually given in this chapter. There are 16 names given. But those two others, their names do appear. They are referred to, and there's no mistaking who they are. And their names do appear in the Bible in Exodus 6, verse 20, and in Numbers 26, verse 59. The names are Amram and Jochebed. Those are Moses' parents. And it just says his parents. But the faithful reference is to them, because it says by faith. Moses was hidden for 3 months. Well, that wasn't up to Moses to have the faith to do that from the time he was born until he was 3 months old. It was Amram and Jochebed, his parents, who did that. So I include them. But it was their faith being referred to. There is an intriguing phrase in just a portion of a verse in Hebrews 11. Well, we'll read the whole verse and read a couple while we're at it. That speaks to the overall view, and it's that other group reference that I was talking about. Mr. Henderson referred to a verse in Hebrews 11 today. I think you're going to find how much the two messages dovetail without overlapping. It's not surprising that that happens from time to time. But in Hebrews 11, verses 39 and 40, that other group phrase appears. It says, "And all these," there's one I already mentioned, "having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promises," or the promise. "God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us." That's the other group word. Us. So how many names are there in Hebrews 11? At this point, it is undetermined. It is undetermined because there will yet be people born in addition to those who are alive now, who both are the called now and are being worked with by God now, and who are not yet called, but who will be given the knowledge of God in the second resurrection. But there are others who have not yet even been born, who will be included as the faithful us. That's the beauty of God's plan. So let me repeat an earlier question. When's the last time that you did really an in-depth study of the faith chapter of Hebrews 11? That study could take several forms, but how about actually setting yourself a goal of researching the lives of those 18 who are mentioned? Now, you'll find if you do that, that there are some interesting differences. First of all, some of them have very little mention in Hebrews 11. Some of the giants of faith that we think of and have large sections, they have large sections of the scripture devoted to their lives and their examples, and there's just a passing reference in Hebrews 11, just their name, that's it. And then there are others in Hebrews 11 who have a multiple number of verses, 6, 7, 8 verses perhaps, in some cases, like Abraham, and also a fairly significant amount of material in the rest of the Bible. But it doesn't always correlate. Some of them have only their names given. For example, look at verse 32 of Hebrews 11. It says, "What more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets." And that's it. There are references then, there are descriptions that follow that apply to some of these people that we know. But as far as much detail, it isn't here. There was much more detail given, for example, to Abraham's life, an example. There's quite a bit more given to Moses. But some of them, not very much. But let's try the concept today of working with one person. That's what I suggested. Take that list of 18 and go through it sometime and do a study on the lives, individual lives, of each of the 18 people who are mentioned, as much as you can find. For some, there's not much. For others, there's quite a bit. The reference to this person is very brief. It's just one verse, but it does give us a little bit of a clue as to what we might find intriguing about his example. It's verse 22. Now, maybe this is topical because this is about where Dr. Levy is in the Foundation Institute online class right now. "By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones." Now, isn't that verse a little bit intriguing to you? When you think of Joseph, what do you think of? Do you think of him, of his saying when he was dying, "Take my bones with you when you leave"? I don't. That's not what leaps to mind. There's a lot said about Joseph in the book of Genesis, several chapters, which we will skim some lessons from today. That's what we're trying to do, is take a look at one example. And like I say, it's current because Dr. Levy is covering it right now in Foundation Institute Online. But here in the faith chapter, the reference that is made is to a rather obscure part of his life and example that you and I would not normally focus on. But that's what we're given. So let's take a look from that angle first, and let's think of a few other possibilities and examples we know. What can it tell us about a person when the snapshot, which is what we have here in Hebrews 11, is taken essentially on his or her deathbed? What can it tell us? Who else do we know that we could check to see? How about a name that's famous? Usually not, we think of, because of chaste, pure, clean living, but a name that is also here in Hebrews 11, and that's Samson. We have a glimpse of his dying moments recorded in the Scriptures. So if you'll turn to Judges chapter 16, we'll take a look. And let's just see what it is we can tell sometimes, what it is that God sees on occasion at this strange and unusual to us, perhaps, one snapshot moment of an existence. Judges chapter 16, we know the story, how he was fooled by Delilah, taken in by his weakness for women, and especially foreign and pagan women who were not part of the knowledge of God's way at that time. And so in verse 21 of Judges 16, then the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters and he became a grinder in the prison. However, it says, the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaven. We know the story about how he was had a Nazirite vow, and therefore that part of that included not shearing or cutting the hair. I'm sure after a while it would have been shearing more than cutting after a certain time period had gone by. Then down to verse 25. So it happened when their hearts were merry. Was talking about a celebration. Verse 23 talks about they gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god. So it happened when their hearts were merry that they said, call for Samson that he may perform for us. What is it about human nature that seems to delight in the suffering and pain of others? That's a not very pretty part of the human experience. Think of the Romans and the gladiators in the arena. It just, again, what is it that is appealing about that? So they called for Samson from the prison, and he performed for them. And they stated, it doesn't say what he did. Perhaps they were mocking certain feats of strength that he had been doing in the past and was no longer able to do. We're not really told. So they stationed him between the pillars. Big mistake. And then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars which support the temple so that I can lean on them. Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, about 3,000 men and women on the roof, watching while Samson performed. And then Samson called to the Eternal and said, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. This was a greatly flawed individual. And yet he was used by God at that time to be a deliverer of his people from subjugation and torment by neighboring nations. And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple. And he braced himself against them, one on his right and the other on his left. And then Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. And all his brothers, his father's household, came down, took him, and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of his father Manoah. He had judged Israel 20 years. Samson was, as I said, a flawed individual. And he lived at a difficult time, terribly challenging, difficult, gruesome times, we would think, from our perspective today. And yet he was used in a certain way. His task as judge was to relieve the oppression of the Philistines on the Israelites. He was not exactly an example we would point to as some of the others, perhaps, but he is listed in the faith chapter as an example at the end of his life, especially, of trusting God and having that faith answered and honored by God. At his death, he came back to the task, grisly as it might seem to us, those of us who have no firsthand experience of what Israel suffered at the hands of their oppressors. There are others that are probably more helpful for our learning, I would think, for our lives and their challenges in a more modern viewpoint. Turn to 2 Timothy chapter 4. This one's also familiar. And it's a snapshot taken at the same time. 2 Timothy chapter 4. It's a personal letter from Paul to Timothy. And we'll begin in verse 5, 2 Timothy 4, verse 5. But you, he says, be watchful in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry. For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. And not to me only, he says, but to all those who have loved his appearing. The New International Version says, who have longed for his appearing. And we should certainly want to put our names in that category of those who long for the appearing of Jesus Christ to return. So here's a focus on Paul when he was dying. What was on his mind? He was urging Timothy forward to carry on God's work for him. He says, you carry on, Timothy. You do the work. You fulfill your calling. And he was very clear on the certainty of his own position in the family and the kingdom of God. I have fought the good fight. How many times have we read those words? I have finished the race. I've kept the faith. The Olympics just began again. Yesterday, last night, was opening day officially, although some events began Thursday, the Winter Olympics. And they've always fascinated me, the Olympics, the concept of the striving, you know, the sitius, altius, fortius, higher, faster, stronger. It's quite a spectacle to watch. I didn't see the opening ceremonies, but I did see a picture in the paper this morning of a gentleman, I think he was from Tonga, I'd have to look it again, in the Winter Olympics, walked in, bare-chested, sandals. It was 20 degrees in Pyeongchang, South Korea. He looked like he was doing okay. Maybe they took the picture just before he collapsed, you know, and started shivering. I don't know. Hopefully he didn't drop his nation's flag, But it's quite the spectacle. Paul often referred to sports events. He talked about the race. He talked about I fight. Frequent references, wrestling. So we have an example of him at his death. Then there's another one in Acts chapter 7. Stephen, the first martyr in the New Testament church, the first one to die for his faith as after the church had begun. Of course, he had a predecessor not too long before him, as we know. But the first after the founding of the New Testament church. I'm not going to read the entirety of his message. We understand that he was giving really, his message amounted to a condemnation of the religious leadership of the time. So I'll pick it up just in verse 57, because we're looking now at a snapshot at the end of life. Acts 7:57, the crowd, it says, then they cried out with a loud voice, stopped their ears, after he had said, look, I see the heavens open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. They stopped their ears, they ran at him with one accord, and they cast him out of the city and stoned him. And it says, and the witnesses laid down their clothes at the feet of a young man named Saul, of whom, of course, we would hear much more later. And they stoned Stephen, as he was calling on God and saying, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." And then he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, "Lord, do not charge them with this sin." And when he had said this, he fell asleep. Snapshot at the close of his life. If you check, you'll find that his two statements that are given here almost exactly replicate two statements made by our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Almost exactly. Because Christ said, as it's recorded, "Into your hands I commend my spirit." And then he also asked God, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing." Interesting that Stephen's mindset, if there's ever an example and a proof of a human being who had the mind of Jesus Christ, Stephen exemplified it with his last two recorded statements. So yes, you can tell a lot. It can't be just a quote-unquote deathbed repentance where the life carries nothing to verify and match what happens in the last few seconds. That's bogus. But when the life is supported by and only is encapsulated in some of the final examples and glimpses we have, you can tell something. Stephen. Of course, who is the one he was emulating? Who is the most powerful example we have? Well, obviously, it's Jesus Christ. Look at Luke chapter 23. We already referred to this. Luke 23, 32. There were two others, criminals, led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand, the other on the left. And then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." And it says they divided his garments and then they cast lots for them. You look at John's account in John chapter 19. Look at John 19 and verse 25 as he notices his mother standing in front of his torture stake. Verse 25, "Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by, he said to his mother, 'Woman, behold your son.'" Now, he wasn't talking about himself, because then he turned to the disciple and said, "Behold your mother." He was pointing them to each other. And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home. Now, we're not told why it was that Jesus took this unusual step. He had at least four brothers, after all. And sisters. We don't know how many sisters. One of the gospel accounts says, "And his sisters, are they not all with us?" Well, "are they not all" would imply strictly at least three. But we don't know. We're not given names. And yet, for some reason of his own choosing, for reasons he knew best, he actually entrusted the care of his mother Mary to John. And of course, John ended up being the one who lived the longest. Maybe that was at least partially a factor. Obviously, Mary would not outlive him. John, we know, lived to be a very old man, probably in his 90s. But in any case, he was still thinking of other people. He was taking care of his mother's needs, what would be up-and-coming needs, in his absence. You look at verses 28 and 29. "After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the Scripture might be fulfilled, said, 'I thirst.'" Why did he say those words? So that the Scripture would be fulfilled. He was thinking in terms of the prophecies about him, making sure they were all fulfilled. He was still doing God's will and fulfilling his purpose right up to his last breath. "Now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there. They filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on hyssop, put it to his mouth. When Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, 'It is finished.' And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. He died. When you look at some of these verses, you realize the importance. He acknowledged his Father's design and purpose and will with his last breaths. Much like Paul said, I've fought the good fight. I've finished the race. So let's get back to Joseph. We see a snapshot at the very end of his life can say a lot. What did it say about Joseph? What was he thinking of as he was dying? Well, he made them promise to take his bones with them when they left servitude in Egypt, or the accoutrements of servitude. Perhaps he could see that that might be coming. He knew they would eventually leave. He just said, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. He was thinking of events yet in the future that were part of the prophecies he had heard, probably some from his father Jacob, about the family's future. He made mention of the departure of the children of Israel. That was all to be a part of his heritage. He knew that God's promises would stand. He knew that his and his brother's descendants would form a nation that would be set apart for a certain purpose in God's design. That was all included in the passing down of the knowledge of the blessings from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob, now to Joseph. And he was determined, even in death, to be part of it. Even in death. I think that says a great deal about his life, don't you? The account says he made this mention by faith. By faith. That's just an overall observation about him. That's what he was like. But let's go back now to the more detailed story of his life. You had a sermonette that spent a fair amount of time in Genesis, and as Mr. Henderson was turning to places, I was thinking, don't go to the 40s, don't go to the chapters in the 40s. Oh, thank you. 2, 3, 25, I can live with. But in Genesis, the account of Joseph's life, the 30s and the 40s of the chapters. His story really begins in chapter 37, even though he is mentioned earlier at the time of his birth. And chapter 38 is an inset chapter dealing with Judah and some of his descendants and how they came to be. So chapters 37 and then 39 right through to the end of the book really tell more of the story. But I'll leave that for you to study and read more. As I say, that's where Dr. Levy is right now in the Foundation Institute online classes. And interestingly enough, one of the four threads from the Bible reading program is in Genesis as well. But instead, let's take a different approach. What can we pull from the account and look at in more detail as we're studying the life of one of those 18 names? See, you only have 17 left. Don't thank me. I've already done part of it for you. The list is not exhaustive. You can probably come up with other factors as well, but I thought of some of these qualities that we can find out about Joseph from the story of his life. The first one is not what you'd necessarily think of as a particularly outstanding characteristic, but it described him early on, and it's something that changed, and that was his youthful naivete. Joseph's youthful naivete. Look at chapter 37, Genesis chapter 37. We'll start right at the beginning. It says, now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, the land of Canaan. This is the story of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Okay, here we go. Joseph tattles on his brothers, the way we might say it today. Not the wisest course, perhaps. Verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph. Israel, of course, is Jacob. Loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. And also he made him a tunic of many colors. Now we have another problem. We have favoritism. Favoritism rarely has good results. Rarely has good results. It usually engenders well, all kinds of animosity and fear of losing a position. It's not a good thing. And not to mention what it does in the person who's being favored, a kind of a sense of entitlement of, well, I deserve this. I'm better than everybody else. Verse 4, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Again, probably predictable. So what would have been the wise choice on his part? Let me give you a clue before we go to verse 5. Verse 5 doesn't show a wise choice on his part. Now Joseph had a dream and he told it to his brothers. Why would you do that? And they hated him even more. And what does he do? He says, oh, excuse me, I won't bring it up again. No, now he wants to give them details. Verse 6. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I've dreamed. I don't want to hear your dream. No, you got to listen to this. It's great, guys. You got to listen. Wait, why do we got to listen? There we were, binding sheaves in the field. There, then behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. Oh boy. Not good. Joseph thought it was great. He was 17 years old, and they were all older except for Benjamin. And his brothers said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. You can expect that. Verse 9 and 10. So he dreamed still another dream, but this time he kept quiet about it. Is that what it says? No, unfortunately, he still hadn't learned. And he told it to his brothers, and he said, look, I've dreamed another dream. Can you imagine the rolled eyeballs at this point? Oh, no. Here we go again. This time, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. Wow. Now, because of events that happened later, I think we can determine that there was a meaning in these dreams. It wasn't just that he had an awful falafel for dinner or something, you know. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him. Why? Because it smacked of pride, right? And haughtiness. And perhaps that was something that Joseph had to learn a bit later in his life. He said, what is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? Now, obviously, his mother was dead. Rachel had died giving birth to Benjamin. So it's clearly a thinking ahead. Jacob's saying, son, what are you talking about? Do you think that somehow, in some future time, we're all going to be subservient to you? Is that what you think this means? His brothers envied him, but look at this phrase, very much like Mary, the mother of Jesus, did much later. His father kept the matter in mind. It says in the New Testament that Mary kept all these things in her heart. So Jacob filed it away mentally to say, you know, there's something there. Still, what Joseph needed more of is found in Proverbs chapter 1. You might want to keep your place in Genesis. I know you're saying too late. Proverbs chapter 1, the very first four verses. Here's the purpose for this book. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. Those are all things that Joseph could have used a heaping helping of when he was a young teenager. Not uncommon, perhaps. Modern research tells us that the development of the adolescent mind isn't completely and fully settled in some directions, in some areas, until about the mid-20s. that it becomes then a fully adult mind, that a full appreciation of risks, for example, among other things. So perhaps he could have used a little bit of help. But you know, even in this, he trusted fully in those dreams God gave him. He believed them. He knew where they were from. Clearly they meant something. He never lost sight of that, as later events in his life would demonstrate. Naive, yes. Faithful, also yes. And they were fulfilled in chapter 44 and verse 14. His brothers did come and bow down to him. But it was part of a bigger thing. It was part of a bigger picture. It wasn't just that his brothers were going to bow to him. It was part of God's plan to do something much larger than just have Joseph be lifted up and elevated. Something much larger. Can we learn from his example, even one part of it that wasn't that great? Another factor, another character quality that certainly comes through from Joseph's life is his diligence. His diligence. Now, you know the story, how his brothers sold him into slavery. A caravan of Midianite slave traders came by. Simeon wanted to kill him. Judah wanted to sell him. And that's what they eventually did. Reuben wanted to deliver him, but it doesn't say where Reuben was when they made the decision to take him out of the well, the dry well, and sell him to the slave traders. Apparently he was not there at the moment, whether he'd gone off hunting or we just don't know. He wasn't apparently around. When he returned and found his brother gone, he was terribly distraught. But he was part of the cover-up still. So chapter 39, it says, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, who was captain of the guard," apparently a rather prestigious position, maybe the commander of the household guard, something of that nature, "an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Eternal was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him and that he made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. He made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. He was such a trustworthy, diligent man that this powerful figure in the government of Egypt could entrust everything to his care and not give it a second thought." Pretty astonishing position to be in. "He clearly made the best of it. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Eternal blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he didn't know what he had except for the bread which he ate." Pretty much, it's pretty interesting. Joseph would come and say, "Here's your allowance for the week." "Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance." Uh-oh. Okay, fellas, don't be sitting out there saying, "Yes, there are so few of us." This was going to lead to trouble. This was going to be trouble. Well, Joseph, you know that old phrase, "It's better to light a candle and curse the darkness"? That's what Joseph tried to do, but unfortunately, somebody else noticed what an outstanding person he was, and that happened to be Potiphar's wife. Mrs. Potiphar she had her eyes wide open to the fact that he was handsome, and he was in form and appearance. Joseph was innocent in this whole sordid mess that was about to play out, as we know. Even though that was true, things did not go well. But even so, his example of dependability and diligence, being someone others could count on, still shone through. You look at verses 21 to 23, after the trumped-up false charges were made, and he was put in prison, it says, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy." Well, he showed him mercy in the first place that he wasn't executed. Obviously, that would have been a fairly serious charge. He was essentially accused of attempted rape. "And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing." So now he's in charge once again. "And the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority." Does that sound like Potiphar? Yes, it does. I mean, it sounds like what Potiphar did, how he treated him. "Because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. The Eternal made it prosper." Remarkable man. Again, making the best of a poor situation. This one was considerably worse than working for Potiphar, yet he didn't quit or pout. He just carried on being who he was and waiting. Can we do that? See, we can learn so much from these examples of faith. What about his incorruptibility? Absolutely incorruptible. Certainly in this one phase. Most easily illustrated in the same overall circumstance in chapter 39. Verse 7, it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, my master doesn't know what is with me in the house. He's committed all that he has to my hand. There's no one greater in this house than I am. Nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against Potiphar?" Not what he says, is it? Sin against God. So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or even to be with her. But it happened about this time, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, none of the men of the house was inside, perhaps by her design. Maybe she banished him all of the house when she saw Joseph coming. Who knows? We don't know. She caught him by his garment and said, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and he fled and ran outside. That's exactly the same advice Paul gave later to the Corinthians, in exactly the same circumstance. Flee sexual immorality. Flee. Get out of there. And so, things didn't go well. The whole sordid mess plays out in the next few verses. She waits till her husband comes home. She holds up Joseph's jacket, says, "The Hebrew that you brought into the house has made a mockery of me. Look what he tried to attack me, assault me. I screamed and I grabbed his jacket and he ran." And of course, he got put in prison. I wonder, did Potiphar suspect something was kind of fishy about this whole thing? Later on, there's a section that we're going to read that makes us think maybe he did. Otherwise, why wasn't he just executed on the spot? Joseph's character shines through in this incident. He simply refused to compromise with sin. One of Mr. Henderson's points about human nature, grossly overestimating the benefits or the pleasures of sin. That's what human nature tends to do. Joseph did not. He put it in its right perspective. What about his humility? You know, early on with his youthful naivete, that may have been something he had to struggle with and work with. But his circumstances were now more humbling than ever. He'd gone from being his father's favorite to being a slave to being a convict. That's pretty bad. Things were not looking up. And yet some circumstances were about to arise that would demonstrate how much God was still with him. And here's the interesting note. Take a look at the first four verses of chapter 40. It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. We're not told how or why. We're not told what the evidence or lack thereof was. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard. Who? Who was Potiphar? Chapter 39, verse 1. Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard. Interesting. He put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And who is going to give instructions personally to Joseph about these two men? Verse 4. The captain of the guard charged Joseph with them. Interesting, isn't it? That makes me wonder if Potiphar ever quite believed the story. And he served them, so they were in custody for a while. Goes on, though. Here's the rest of the story. I just thought that was an interesting side note. Then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, had a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. Joseph came into them in the morning, and he saw them, and he saw that they were sad. He was very attuned to the moods and the feelings and how those around him were doing. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody, it says, if I can turn the page, of his Lord's house, saying, "Why do you look so sad today?" And they said to him, "We each have had a dream, and there's no interpreter of it." So Joseph said, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please." Interesting. Look at two things here. His concern for his fellow prisoners, even to the point of asking, "Why such long faces?" And two, the sure faith that God was still with him. He said, "Don't interpretations belong to God? Please tell me your dreams." That's kind of sticking your neck out a little bit, isn't it? But he did. Now, of course, now in all of this, it's possible that Joseph could see God's hand in this situation already. And he would perhaps have come to a conclusion, I think it's obvious that he did after what happened, that this was the way God was going to answer and remove him from jail and put him into some kind of responsibility that he thought those dreams must mean. But it didn't quite turn out that way exactly. The humility was there right from the start. He gave God the credit. Once more, he takes the opportunity to ask for action from the chief butler. As you read through, he tells them their dreams. The butler's dream was that he is taking grapes and pressing them into Pharaoh's cup, this budded vine. Three vines. He said, "Well, here's the interpretation. Three branches or 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will pardon you and you'll be restored to your position." The baker heard that. He said, "Great, let me try my dream now." And his dream wasn't so great. His dream was, "In 3 days, you're going to be hanged." And both of them happened exactly as Joseph foretold. And as he was saying goodbye to the butler from prison, he says, "Remember me. Remember me." But the chief butler, verse 23 of chapter 40, did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. How must that have seemed to Joseph? He was now 28 years old. He'd been in slavery or prison for 11 years, the total combined. Probably more in prison than in slavery. I suspect Potiphar's wife tumbled to his good looks sooner rather than later, let's put it that way. So, more time goes by. You know, it's interesting. In reading over this material, preparing for the sermon, I put myself into the shoes of the chief baker and asked, what must those last 3 days of his life been like? But then another thought struck me. What if he was actually guilty? What if the butler was innocent and he was restored, and the baker was guilty and he was hanged? We don't know. We're not told. There are so many questions. You know, just start making a list, you know, and in the resurrection, we'll all have our time. We can sit down and say, now, who can, let's see, Joseph, just ask Jesus Christ. He'll be able to answer them all. We may have to make an appointment, but I don't think time's going to be a factor with him. Humanity has written such a sad tale. We don't know specifically what these two officers were charged with, why they were in the dungeon. Pharaoh was angry. Joseph's humility would surface again 2 years later. We find in chapter 41, Pharaoh had two dreams, and they both had the same meaning. And now, of course, the butler says, "Oh, I remember. And won't this be a good feather in my cap with the Pharaoh if I tell him somebody who can solve this problem for him?" So that's what he did. It says in verse 9, the chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, saying, "I remember my faults this day. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker, we each had a dream in one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. There was a young Hebrew man with us there, a servant of the captain of the guard." Interesting phrase. Even in prison, he's referred to by the butler as a servant of the captain of the guard. Maybe because the captain of the guard had given specific care instructions to Joseph about the butler and the baker. We don't know. "And we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each man he interpreted according to his own dream, and it came to pass. Just as he interpreted, so it happened. He restored me to my office, he hanged him." Then Pharaoh sent. Now put yourself now in Joseph's shoes. In slavery, and in prison for 13 years. 2 years have gone by. He is now 30, we're told, when he stood before Pharaoh. One morning he gets up, no different from any other morning, until fairly early in the day, because Pharaoh had the dreams during the night. Obviously things would have been put in motion fairly quickly. Suddenly there's a rustling and a banging, and somebody comes in and says, "Quick, quickly, you've got to clean up, you've got to shave, you've got to change your clothing, you're going somewhere. Where am I going? Just hurry." And they take him out of the prison, and they brought him, and they came to Pharaoh. Wow, your head would be swimming, wouldn't it? And Pharaoh said, "I've had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it." You know the story. I won't read through each part of the chapter. But we see Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, "It's not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace." So he interprets the two dreams. They both have the same meaning, the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine. Verse 28, "This is the thing which I've spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do." Then he explains it a little bit. Come down to verse 38. Pharaoh had even asked advice. Well, Joseph gave it. "Let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man." Now Joseph put that forward. That was a little bold. "Let Pharaoh do this. Let him appoint officers over the land. Let them gather all the food. It'll be a reserve," and so on. Verse 37, "The advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh, in the eyes of all his servants." I wonder if Joseph didn't see now this was it. This was the moment. And so he was perhaps inspired by God to put forward this advice. Generally, if you offer unsolicited advice to a tyrannical ruler, it doesn't end well. In this case, it ended very well. Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God?" Or the Spirit of the gods, perhaps, would have been more likely from a multicultural belief in many gods. "Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there's no one as discerning and wise as you. You'll be over my house. All my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." This all happened in one day. One astonishing day after 13 years. Now you follow through a little bit later and see that he is given a wife. He has two children. In verse 51, it says, "He called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my toil. And he called the name of the second Ephraim, for God has made me to be fruitful." Even in the naming of his sons, he was keeping in mind what God had done for him. His humility shows again. To whom does he give the credit? What about Joseph's resourcefulness and wisdom? Maybe that seems to contradict the first point. When he explained the meaning to Pharaoh, he was both bold and proactive, and he suggested a practical course of action. You notice the name that Pharaoh gave him in verse 45. It says, "He called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah." Now that'd be a little bit hard to, roll off your tongue quickly, but basically it meant God speaks and he lives, according to the marginal reference. God speaks and he lives. Joseph has conducted himself so wisely as to demonstrate God's overall supremacy. Even to Pharaoh, who probably considered himself a god of some kind, that wasn't unusual back in those cultures. But it meant that every time Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, he'd be reminded of the circumstances of Joseph's rise. "Hello, call for God speaks and he lives. I want to talk to him. I want to speak to God speaks." It was Joseph. That was the name in Egyptian. He was so revered by the Egyptians that we find out later in the book of Exodus that it required a Pharaoh who did not know Joseph to begin the enslavement of the Israelites. Various translations render that as had no knowledge of Joseph, did not know about Joseph, or one says felt no obligation to the descendants of Joseph. We still get the sense of what would come. One more incident, I think, demonstrates his resourcefulness. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but you'll see in chapter 47 that once his family came to Egypt, that he suggested they settle in Goshen. or they he was given that option, he told them to tell the Pharaoh that their job was herding flocks. They were herdsmen. Remember what was one of the big problems with Egypt? What was the false god that the Israelites later built in the desert? It was a golden calf. The Israelites worshipped some of these animals. The Egyptians worshipped some of these animals. And so Joseph said to his brothers, you tell Pharaoh that your main job is you herd flocks and keep animals. That wouldn't go over well with Egyptians who worshipped some of these. So they would isolate them. They would put them by themselves in a fertile area. And later on, in fact, they were even given some of the royal herds to look after when those animals began coming in as payment during the years of famine. They're very, very resourceful. What about Joseph's love and lack of resentment? You ever think about that? What would have been the normal human reaction when he realized that his brothers were standing before him buying grain? Well, he acted a little strongly at first. He put Simeon in prison and he sent them all home. He returned their money. But as they come back before him in chapter 43, we find the story developing. Judah implores his father. He says, please, you must allow Benjamin to come with us. And Jacob, of course, says, why did you even tell him you had another brother? But as the story unfolds, instead of dealing harshly with his brothers, he tells them something astonishing. First of all, he treats them well. He gives them a massive banquet in the end of chapter 43. But then there's another little stratagem in chapter 44. He puts the money back in their grain sacks, and he has his special governor's silver cup put in Benjamin's sack. And then he sends his servants after them. When they catch up to the brothers, they say, why have you treated your lord, your hosts, so badly? And they say, we don't know what you're talking about. If anybody finds this special cup, let him die, and the rest of us will become servants. And the chief steward says, no, that's too much. You know, just the one who stole the cup is servants. The rest of you can go on your way. And, of course, they end up being brought back before Joseph because the cup is found in Benjamin's sack. They try explaining, but they go back to Egypt, and the account is so powerful in chapter 45. Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried out, make everyone go out from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. He'd been using an interpreter before that, and they didn't know that he understood every word they spoke. Can you imagine that scene? Does my father still live? His brothers couldn't answer. They were dismayed in his presence. You could just see them backing up and staring. And he said to his brothers, come near to me. And they came near. He said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now they've got to wonder, now what's next? He says, first thing he said to reassure them, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me there or here. God sent me before you to preserve life. He doesn't tell them, my dream's going to come true. Nah, 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 nah. You bowed down to me when you came before me last week. He doesn't say that. He said, God sent me here to preserve life. That's what all of it means. All of it means. He explains, there will be 5 more years of famine. You need to come down here. Go and get my father. Come here with everything you have. I can look after you here. He says, it wasn't you who sent me here, but God. That's an astonishing take on things. His total lack of resentment. You look at, as he the report is made, verse 16, to Pharaoh's house, Joseph's brothers have come. It pleased Pharaoh and his servants well. Pharaoh adds on, he says, Load your animals and depart. Go to the land of Canaan. Bring your father, your household goods. I'll supply carts. I'll supply whatever you need. You know, Beacons Moving and Storage is at your disposal. Or maybe Memphis Moving and Storage or Cairo Moving and Storage is at your disposal. And Jacob believed his sons. When he saw the carts, it says, verse 27, when he saw the carts from Egypt, he said, I'm going to go. My son is still alive. Quite a story. There was one final way in which Joseph demonstrated this in a very powerful way in the last chapter of the book of Genesis. His total lack of resentment to his brothers. Genesis 50 and verse 14. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt. He and his brothers all went up with him to bury his father. When his brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us, and he may actually repay us for all the evil we did to him. So they sent messengers and said, before your father died, he issued a command. Say to Joseph, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin. Now that may have been true. Jacob may have said that. And so they plead, now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers went and fell down before his face and said, we are your servants. Once again, the dream came true. Joseph said, don't be afraid. For am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant it for evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them, and he spoke kindly to them. What a remarkable, remarkable man. We don't know too many more, but then the last three verses of Genesis, the event that we saw in Hebrews is reflected here. Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then he took an oath from the children of Israel. That's probably the reference to brethren, his whole family, because he was among the younger. We wouldn't assume that they all outlived him. He took an oath saying, God will visit you and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died being 110 years old and they embalmed him and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Not buried in the midst of a tomb and a pyramid where they couldn't get at him. It just says they put him in a coffin. So there was easier access. Interesting. What a story. What a lifetime. Well, that's one name of the 18 that are named in Hebrews 11. Now, for the second example, and the third, and the fourth, and all the way to the 18th, that's your job. That's your job. There's so much more we could say. It's like it says in Hebrews, time would fail me to tell. Very true. Today wasn't a typical sermon in some ways, perhaps, but it matches, like I said, where we are in the Foundation Institute, online presentations, even the Bible reading program. And there's so much. That one chapter of Hebrews 11 has a wealth of information when you expand it out like this and you find little nuggets. I stumbled across that bit about the fact that it was apparently Potiphar who gave him instructions about the butler and the baker getting this sermon ready. You know where I found it? In the old Bible story book by Basil Wolverton. Isn't that surprising where sometimes you find things? We really only covered one verse from Hebrews 11 today, verse 22, about Joseph. There are 17 more names for, anyway, a lot, for you to study. How about you find more lessons from the faithful ones who went before us? And don't forget that last word. One day, maybe there will be an expanded list of the faithful servants of God, one that surely, as it even is now, includes you and me, that all-encompassing word in Hebrews 11, us.